Okay, so words are important, and we must find out what words mean in the original language. And I want to tell you that this study of words, I think that's what text study is all about. And it surely enriches your preaching when you work with these words and find out what the original meanings of those words were for the people who first heard this and in the whole context of biblical revelation. Well, we have this word in our text, propitiation. That means mercy seat. It's a lid on the lid of the Ark of the Covenant on which the blood of sacrifice was sprinkled. And I think of the 1 Corinthians 4:1, let a man so account of us as of the ministers of Christ. That Greek word for ministers there is not diakonos, but it's hyperetes. And that means an under rower, a galley slave. Well, I just want to tell you that's all you need to write a whole big section of a sermon of your sermon. A minister is a galley slave of Jesus Christ. He takes orders from Christ. He listens to Christ. He serves Christ. He's responsible to Christ. Don't you see how much there is in a picture like that? Work with these words. There are sermons in words. Now you've got this word love, such a common word, used so much. What in the world does that mean here? To try to explain this in a sermon to people, the meaning of love, it's a challenge. It's a big job. All right. Now I want to tell you something. About this, well, first of all, I want to say a little about tenses in Greek. You know, these tenses are really important. The present tense with its continuing action, the aorist with its once for all action completed, and the perfect with its action completed in the past, with its effects continuing into the present. Boy, it's pretty important to see which tenses you have in front of you and to use them in your preaching, because they add another dimension to your preaching. All right, so now after you've done this, after you've really worked at the Greek and worked hard at it, then what I like to do at least is look at other versions and see how other men have translated it. Now there are an awful lot of versions around, and I would get all the versions I can. One famous preacher told me that I could have all his commentaries if he could keep all the versions which he has. Well, I don't know whether I want to throw or whether he should throw away his commentaries that fast. But what he was trying to tell me is that the versions are very important, and that's true. Very often you get a text like in the King James, it doesn't talk very well. And you read a thing like Phillips or the New English Bible or any of the other translations, and all of a sudden you hit on one that really makes the text march, and it's real helpful. And so I think on, you know, on these pages where you have one page per verse, I think that you ought to list on there variant translations that are of significance. If they're not of any significance, I don't know why you should list them. But if you get a phrase that somebody else used, you know, very often that may be very helpful in your final writing of the sermon or the way you phrase your sermon. I think Phillips is good at that. You know, Phillips is a paraphrase and you have to watch him. But I think his language is striking at times, and at times it's very usable. And on this matter of studying these words and being verbally accurate, I want to call your attention to these word books that are around. You know, there's one by Alan Richardson, theological word book of the Bible, and Jean-Jacques von Alman, A Companion to the Bible. And Barclay has, you're acquainted with Barclay, I suppose, B-A-R-C-L-A-Y, has a book, New Testament Word Book, and he also has another volume entitled More New Testament Words. Well, I think it's these word books are real helpful. Of course, then there's also Robertson's Word Studies in the New Testament. I don't know, I think it's about a five-volume work. These books on words, as they're used, you know, in the Bible, are enormously helpful. I like to read up on these different words and see how they say the word is used in the sacred writings, because that becomes very helpful. Now, okay. Now, what's the next thing you do? Well, I think you ought to take a real hard look now at the doctrines which you have in your text, because, you see, you're going to preach these doctrines, and you can't presume that you know everything there is to know about them, and so you have to keep your dogmatics book handy to read up on the doctrine which is treated in your text. And you notice from our study before, there are a number of doctrines in this text. Well, I would do that. And then what's the next thing you try to do? Well, let's suppose you've been studying away here and you've got all kinds of ideas. Now you try to group the ideas, you see. What you're doing, in effect, is making an initial outline. And I think this is about the time to do it. You must have all kinds of thoughts written down by this time. Now you try to group the ideas. And I always ask myself for the first question, well, what's this writer talking about? What is he trying to say? What is the intended sense of the Holy Spirit in this text? It isn't too hard to find in this text. That's why this is an easier text, because it's a hortatory text, and he's encouraging us to love one another, I suppose. That's what he's trying to do. And then you have to see how these other ideas relate to the central idea. In other words, you're sorting ideas out. What is the focal idea? That's going to be your theme, ultimately. And then what are the major ideas? These major ideas are going to be your parts, ultimately, you see. What are the minor ideas? Well, they're going to be subordinate parts in your outline. In other words, what you're doing now, in effect, is developing an outline. And you have to ask yourself, you know, what the practical value of this sermon is, what you're trying to achieve with it. That becomes the goal of your sermon. All these things are things that you do at this stage of the game. In other words, you're trying to put this puzzle together again, see? And to make it all come out. You're trying to write a practical, a textual, an edifying sermon. And that's about where you're at now. And I never go to books to read what other men have written on something until I have spent time with this text myself. Until I've gotten to the point where I have a basic outline for this text. Because in all my years of experience, I can tell you that the text, the ideas I go with when I preach are those that I get as a result of the simple study of the text. That's all you need. Because you're just reading commentaries and other men's sermons to help clarify ideas. That's one function of commentaries. And to get any additional ideas that you may have omitted in your preliminary study. So at this stage, you're interested in putting the puzzle together in terms of main ideas and subordinate ideas. Now here I'd probably take another sheet of paper and try to develop an outline, a simple outline. And in this stage, I always try to encourage the students to let the text do the talking, you know. If I can get a theme right out of the text and get my parts right out of the text, I like that best of all. because there's no use playing games. I'm preaching on this text. And if this text give me these ideas, I don't know why those ideas can't be my themes and theme and parts. So that's the point you're at now. Now, as a final point, I think you're ready now to read commentaries. And I want to caution you not to read commentaries until you reach this point. Because if you read too soon, then you're going to get all mixed up. One commentator will say you better go this way, another will say you better go that way, and finally you don't know which way to go. And you're not trusting your own ideas either. And I think a person ought to trust his own ideas, because I'm persuaded that if you're excited about saying a certain thing, probably you better say it. And you better say it your way. I can't write sermons the way somebody else does, and I don't expect them to write sermons the way I do. The things I see, and they mean much to me, are things I'm going to be able to talk about. And I think you ought to have that self-confidence, and I'm going to try to help build that confidence in you. But there comes a time when we should read what other men have written, and then I think we ought to read ourselves full. We ought to read everything that we can find our hands on this text. Now, so we're going to the commentaries. Now, we go to commentaries to clarify ideas, and another important purpose for which we read is to get parallel passages and to get illustrations. Now, those you usually find those in commentaries. Now, I want to encourage you to use parallel passages, because they help to clarify the idea. They give the sermon power. You know, you hear a sermon where scripture is quoted, you get the idea that this isn't just something that the speaker is dreaming up. These aren't his own opinions. This is what God's Word says, and that becomes authoritative for us, doesn't it? So note the parallel passages that you find from your reading in the commentary, and these notes that you take from commentaries ought to be added to the materials, you know, that you have on these individual sheets that you have for individual verses in the text. Or you just add your commentary ideas. Now, which commentaries should you use? Well, every man has to find his own, finally. There are a few that I'm a little bit partial to, because I've used them for so many years. I want to say a good word for the pulpit commentary. I don't know whether your exegetical profs say much about it, but over the years I found the pulpit commentary to be pretty helpful. For one thing, it's not so popular that it ignores the Greek and Hebrew in the text, and you find pretty decent text exposition there. And that's been helpful to me. When there are problems in the text, I think the pulpit doesn't skirt them, but it tries to tackle them. And it does it in a few words, and that's helpful too. In addition, the pulpit commentary also has homilies by various authors. And once in a while, you get an idea out of that. So I think for homiletical purposes, the pulpit commentary is real good. Besides, it's pretty good on the Old Testament. And then, of course, I like Barnes Notes. Now, Barnes is a Baptist, but I like it because it's popular, and he has a lot of practical applications of the text. Now, I always keep Kretzmann around as a kind of a standard by which to finally judge the interpretation of a difficult passage. Lenski is pretty good. Lenski gets a little bit opinionated once in a while. You know, he says it has to be this way and it can be no other way, and that bothers us once in a while. But he's still a pretty good exegete. And, from there, I think you ought to keep your ears open to the commentaries that your professors are recommending, particularly in the exegetical courses, and build your library around recommended books. So then you read commentaries, see, and they flesh out your ideas. Well, that's what they're for, and we're thankful. What about reading other men's sermons? Well, somebody said, you know, you should gather your flour wherever you can, but you ought to bake your own bread. Now, you know what that means. You read around in commentaries and read around in other men's sermons, but you still write your own. Now, I think if you maintain a spirit of independence, you're going to discover this, that once in a while you get an idea from another man's sermon, but it's awfully hard to copy another man's sermon. Not if you want to be independent and you want to speak your message to the people and not somebody else's message. If you do that, you really can't take another man's sermon and simply put that out, you know. There's one thing I didn't mention when I was talking about the use of words, and that is the use of concordances. Well, you know, like Cruden's or Young's or Strong's, these concordances are helpful because they give you a variety of passages which use the same word that's used in your text that you're concerned with, you know. Well, and you can see how the word is used in different contexts. I have at my side all the time Cruden's Small Concordance, because a lot of times I think of passages, you know, I don't have to go for them as much as have them come to me. And I know this passage is someplace in the Bible. Well, if I have Cruden's little concordance there, that helps me to identify the passage so that I can look it up. I think that a book like Are You Acquainted with Knaves, N-A-V-E, Knaves, Topical Concordance, or Harper's Topical Concordance, you know, it lists passages under different topics. For instance, if you look up the word love in there, well, it'll list, and it has the passages written out, so that's a pretty good source for finding parallel passages that fit. So I thought I'd draw these books to your attention, too. Now, with regard to these parallel passages, you know, you have to be sure that they fit, because if a parallel passage doesn't fit, probably it's better unused than used. Well, that's about what I have to say about these initial steps in sermonizing. Of course, here, then, you go from this initial outline that you have, to your full-blown outline. Now, this initial outline is usually pretty brief, and you really oughtn't to expand it either until you're pretty much sold on the initial outline. If you expand these outlines too fast, then the chances are that if something's wrong, you won't know where it's wrong. In other words, if I put down a theme in a couple of parts, you know, well, boy, I better look at those real hard to be sure I'm satisfied with them. And then I expand those parts. You see, I take part A and I'll subdivide that into a couple of main ideas and keep expanding that way. In other words, the outline should grow, but it should grow from on solid footings, you know it. That's why it's important to look at this initial outline that you have. Be sure that's okay, and then if that's okay, then you go to expand it, and the thing ought to stand up when you're all finished. This expansion, it can go to a number of pages. In fact, the matter is, my theory of sermonizing says that you spend about, 75 to 80% of your time on your outline. About 10% on writing it and 10% on learning it. Now, at this stage of the game, you may think that these proportions are off, but after you've done this a little while, I think that you'll agree that those proportions are pretty accurate. In other words, this outlining is tough, hard work because it involves thinking. But you've got to get everything set before you can start to write. See, you're something like an architect. An architect doesn't build a building, but he's got everything laid out so that he can give those plans to somebody else and he can build a building that's going to stand up. Now, that's what your outline is. It's architect's work, and that's hard work. That has to be precise work. But believe me, the sermon that finally comes out of that is going to reflect the careful planning that went into this particular sermon. Okay, I think that that's probably sufficient on this lecture on the initial steps.